All right, well, good afternoon to everybody here in person and those that are watching via Zoom. So if my eyes are not on the camera, I apologize. I am looking at our audience who decided to brave the rain of Jacksonville to come here and be with us in person. So I want to thank our distinguished guest, Tim Carney, for traveling all the way to Jacksonville to be with us this afternoon for an engaging discussion. Tim is a senior political columnist at the Washington Examiner, and he's also the author of 3 books. And I have to read the whole name of the title because I think it's important to frame the discussion today. The first book, The Big Ripoff, How Big Business and Big Government Steal Your Money. Obamanomics, How Barack Obama is Bankrupting You and Enriching His Wall Street Friends, Corporate Lobbyists, and Union Bosses. And the book that we're primarily here to discuss today, Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. In addition to being an author and a columnist, Tim is also a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he works on economic competition, cronyism, civil society, localism, and religion in America. Before we get into my questions, I do want to remind everybody that we will save some time at the end for questions. So if you're here in person, please jot them down on a piece of paper and Adam, you know, wave it up in the air. Adam will come by and grab it. If you're watching via Zoom, please use the chat or Q&A function, and we will monitor that throughout the event. So let's get into our discussion. So Tim, in Alienated America, you start the book writing about when your daughter Eve was in the PICU, and you and your wife experienced the power of community and social capital, that outpouring of support from family, friends, neighbors, coworkers, fellow parishioners. Your book is really, what I see it as, it's a great complementary book to J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. And you really tackle the data and the reason why so many voters were drawn to then-candidate Donald Trump and his statement, "The American dream is dead." So at the beginning of the book, you write this, quote, "The materialistic view of the American dream is that of stock market, decent wages for Trump voters, white Christian privilege, but that misses the point." And you write, "The worst analysis assumes that wealth or the opportunity for wealth is the American dream." So can you just first kind of tell us why you decided to tackle this daunting task that the American dream is dead kind of really resonated with Trump voters? And then just the journey that you endeavor going to Pittsburgh and Iowa, Toledo, and the areas that are forgotten America.
Yeah, well, thank you. And it's an honor to be here. This is my second time speaking to live humans in a year. So, and when I speak to non-lawyers next, that'll be even more of a human audience, I suppose. I'm joking. My father's a lawyer. I have 2 brothers who are lawyers. I was on the track to be a lawyer before I came into journalism. And that's sort of how I came across writing this book. I love traveling to all parts of America, and I go to Iowa a lot. And so as a journalist, my answer to your question obviously begins in Iowa. I'm an Irish Catholic, so the story begins in a bar. It was called Joe's Place in Iowa City, and I met a couple, worked at the university. The woman was from Orange City, Iowa. And as I said, I'm an Irish Catholic, so the color orange can be triggering to me. So I said, what exactly is orange about Orange City? And she said, we're Dutch. As a guy from New York, there were like 2 ethnicities. There were 3 white ethnicities. You were Italian, Irish, or Jewish. And by the way, the last lawyer's chapter I spoke to was out in Long Island, and literally everybody there was Irish, Italian, or Jewish. And so Dutch was a new thing to me. So I said, how Dutch are you? In Orange City, Iowa. And she said, let me put it this way. I used to march in wooden clogs past Windmill Square for the annual Tulip Festival. And this wasn't back in the Netherlands. This was in Sioux County, Iowa. It sounded like a Simpsons episode send-up. So I went out there, and I've been out there a few times. And if you've ever been blessed to be to Sioux County, Iowa, it is, let me put it this way. The problems that plague rural America are almost absent there. dropouts is at the lowest, drug abuse is at the lowest, out of wedlock births is at the lowest. It's the most tight-knit community I have found in visiting small towns around the country, rural America around the country. And then something happened at the election there. It was Donald Trump's worst county in the 2016 caucuses, and then became his best county in the 2016 general election. And I went to Michigan for their primaries. I went to Holland, Michigan, and the other Dutch places, and Trump bombed in those places. And so, and then Oostburg, Wisconsin, the same story. And so what I realized was that these communities I was finding that were incredibly tight-knit, that had not just high religiosity, but real high church attendance, that they were rejecting in the primaries the guy who said the American dream is dead. And so I thought that told us something about the American dream, especially when you saw that Trump was also losing primaries in the places like Chevy Chase, Maryland, Brett Kavanaugh's hometown, down the road from me. I'm in a more middle-class part of Montgomery County, but that these two varying types of places, these sort of rich liberal elite places, Trump bombed in the Republican primaries, and these very conservative Christian places, Trump bombed in the Republican primaries. So I formed the hypothesis that Trump's appeal in the early primaries was that the American dream was dead, and that he did the worst in the places it was most alive, and it was most alive in places where strong institutions, whether they be the Christian Reformed Church or the Chevy Chase Club, strong institutions bring people together. Again, whether they be secular or strong public school, and that community is this necessary infrastructure for the good life. And that I had missed this idea that the American dream was dead, because as you referred to my daughter in the hospital, when she was there, we had this problem of too much food in our second fridge. And all of you know what I'm talking about. If you have a baby, if somebody in your family is in the hospital, if a parent dies, if you get a diagnosis of cancer, think about what happens. All these people are bringing you meals, and it always includes dessert. So every time we have a baby, and we've had six of them, I end up putting on baby weight. But that those meals don't just come from our friends because we're great and have so many friends. It's always, I found myself just talking to the women at the hospital. I said, oh, that was a couple from our pool. That was a family from our parish. That was somebody whose kid I coached in T-ball. There was always an institution that linked us. So that's what Alienated America was about, was how the struggles of working class America, whether it be inner city African Americans or Appalachian whites or J.D. Vance's family, it's a crisis of connection, that they don't belong to enough things. And I had so much fun writing it, and I'm always grateful for opportunities to talk about it.
Well, and before we go into some of the more substance of the book, I saw your column from yesterday. For those in the audience, Tim was in McClenny this past weekend, kind of experiencing a different part of Florida. And I thought it was interesting, you write about your interactions at two different bars, Gator Patrick's and Crooker Rooster Brew Pub, which I will now have on my list of places to go. But then also that you were at St. Mary Mother of Mercy. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of these personal connections you make when you're going into smaller towns. And I thought this was something that I'd really love you to touch on. You said that you got into an argument at one of the bars about systemic and subconscious racism. But even though you got into an argument, the locals still ended up buying you your beers. So kind of talk about what it's like being an author, going into these towns, asking tough questions, but then at the end of the day, still having a good relationship with the locals.
And I had to include that they bought my beers as a matter of disclosure, which this crowd, I think, would appreciate. I spoke good of the bar, but the having my beers bought for me might have affected my view on it. So it actually started 8 years ago. I came to Jacksonville to speak to a student FedSoc chapter, and I had included, so go back even further, my first book came out in 2006. I had written about McClenny because I'd been researching subsidies to Walmart. And McClenny jumped out because the Walmart distribution center got the land for free, and there was all this new, you know, infrastructure investment. And rather than assess Walmart for some of that, the county paid for it. And then the federal government trained the workforce for them, and everything was paid for. And this was this totally free distribution center. And I was writing about how these big guys get this unfair advantage. And so I said, hey, I'm going to be near McClenny. I got to go see how this Walmart distribution center plays. And the quotes I got, the F Walmart, the, oh, they were a horrible employer. When my son got sick, they laid him off. It just, it was awesome for me because I was beating up on Walmart for taking all this corporate welfare, and the locals in McClenny were beating up on Walmart for not being a good employer. And then I got this letter from a local who said, the only thing you did in McClenny was go to a dive bar and a barbecue joint, and you talked to the people who were at a bar on a Monday night. You didn't talk to the people who were coming out of church on Sunday. And my first thought was, oh, I guess maybe those are different people, because I'm an Irish Catholic from New York, and those are not necessarily different people where I come from. And so 8 years later, I got a chance, thanks for your invitation, to go to McClenny, and I made sure to talk to the people in the church parking lot and to go to more than just Gator Patrick's, and found all sorts of different views. So it was a lesson for me as a journalist in seeing different perspectives. But what you're referring to was also my realization. I go into Gator Patrick's both times, and they're different. My two different visits, different Confederate flags on the wall. They're at least once in every place I go to, they say, oh, well, the only problem with McClenny is you got all these Yankees moving in. And the first time I ever reported from the South, there was like a shirt for sale at a gas station saying, Yankee, go home. And all this bluster and all this, you go to a Trump rally and you're in the little media bullpen. Oh, you're the enemy of the people. For all that, I walk in, I say, I'm a reporter. I'm from New York. I live in DC. And they say, well, why are you in McClenny? And I said, well, I'm trying to learn about your town. Next thing you know, they're like calling people, hey, come down to the bar so you can meet this guy. Oh, thanks for writing about us. You should write about this. And then buying me Jaeger bombs, not my favorite. It was micro brews at the Crooked Rooster, which was a little more my speed. But that the welcomingness, and I say in the piece, I say, would it have been different if I were not a white male? I'm sure. But that for me, like, I voted against Trump in the general election both times. I wrote lots of things against him. So I'm sort of like a never Trumper, college educated, elite guy from Greenwich Village. And I don't hide any of this from them. And I make it clear that I'm a journalist. But there's something about my approaching them with a real curiosity and saying, so what is life like here? It parenting? How hard is it? What are the challenges? What do you think of the Walmart? All these questions that are this real curiosity, I find this welcoming of me as flesh and blood. It's kind of like people hate their congressman, hate Congress, but they love their congressman. I feel like people who hate the media, if you approach them with actual curiosity and love, you're likely to get it back. Again, I'm not precluding that that my being a white male makes it much, much easier for me, but it was still a good observation amid all the Yankee go home bluster that it was, I got invited to a wedding. They're holding a wedding at Gator Patrick's. They said, you should come back on Saturday for a wedding. That has never happened to me in New York. So,
well, so going into the book, and I think like you mentioned, you're going into different, you know, small towns, what I think we all commonly hear is like forgotten America or middle America. One of the interesting points in your book, and you kind of build on this growing, you know, data set, and Senator Sasse covered it in the Vanishing American Adult. We've got a lot of adult, able-bodied individuals, mostly males, that are completely leaving the workforce. Mm-hmm. And it's just a lack of working. They're playing video games. They're watching TV. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about some of the unintended consequences that maybe we're not realizing from having this vanishing adult in the workforce. What does that do to communities in America overall, based on your experiences?
I really believe that work is essential to the good life. And I don't necessarily even mean paid work. I think If these guys were dropping out of the workforce to be stay-at-home dads or to be like full-time volunteers at their church, that would be good for them. But what data shows is that it's mostly time spent on devices, the phone, video games, TV. Porn is probably a big part of it. It's disastrous to individuals to not work, and it's disastrous to communities. Often this, there's the causality goes both ways in almost everything I discuss in that book, but men dropping out of the labor force is both a result and a cause of the retreat from marriage in the working class. I treat the retreat from marriage as two different things. The sort of elite, not really getting married less, just getting married later. And so because more women go to college. And so statistically that looks like getting married less, but that's not really happening. So it's not like the liberal elite women, feminists aren't getting married. That's statistically almost not happening. What's really happening is the working class is getting married less. And part of it is because the men are less likely to have stable jobs. We could spend 2 hours on the root causes of this. But I ultimately put it at an erosion of broad deinstitutionalization, erosion, loss of reliable work, loss of reliable community, loss of church, the retreat from family, again, both causes and results from this. And so you see deaths of despair is another one of the very tangible consequences of this, suicide, alcohol, drug use. But the one that I spend most time on is the not getting married. And then what position does that leave so many women in working class America? The same stories that we've heard since Daniel Moynihan about inner city Black families are 100% true about a lot of rural American white families, where the women have a baby and just say, I'm single and that guy isn't even working. I'm not sure that I benefit. He would be another mouth for me to feed, is the story you get from a lot of those places. And so when there's a single mom and an uninvolved dad, guess what there isn't? There's not a basketball coach. There's not a t-ball coach. There's not somebody joining the PTA. There's not an involved parent who can go all to all the back to school nights. There's not somebody to, you know, be the timer at the local swim team meet. That you, once you lose that two-parent household, you lose the ability of families to really add to and build community. And then that creates more suffering for the other people in the community. So it really is this negative ripple.
Yeah, and you write about, you make that connection where without having those communal and civil society associations, you quote to Tocqueville that, you know, one of the real attractions to America is our moral associations that we all have, that the American dream is really a robust community. And that when that erodes, when we become more isolated from each other, we create what you call civil society deserts. Mm-hmm. And so can you tell us a little bit more about that? And I think the question that we all have would be, well, how do we reverse course then on all of these civil society deserts?
Yeah, and I think that's a really important question. And what goes along with that is, I talk about privilege in the book, and I say what a lot of people who are doing well off don't realize is that their greatest privilege is their connection, that your income is an incredible privilege, but it's inseparable from the fact that you belong to things. I mean, you guys belong to the Federalist Society to start, other professional associations. If you went to law school and went to college, the odds are disproportionately high that, unlike J.D. Vance, you were raised in a situation where your parents were putting you in groups and clubs and Little League and marching band, whatever. And that's our greatest privilege, the things that we belong to, because one of the misperceptions I try to get over here is, I remember talking to a high school friend of mine, and she went to Oberlin as like a liberal hippie farmer in Vermont. And I said something about middle America and Appalachia. And she said, well, they lack money, but they're all church going people with a lot of solidarity on the local level. I said, that's not my experience. There are strong towns that are pretty tight knit. I think McClenny actually is fairly tight-knit, interestingly enough. But a lot of working-class rural American towns do not, I mean, this is what bowling alone was about. This is Charles Murray wrote Coming Apart. And it was about these places don't just lack money. They lack, I was in Uniontown, Pennsylvania at a bar called Smitty's. This after I wrote the book, I went back there and the bartender said, well, Uniontown's not that bad of a place to raise your kid. You just always have to know exactly where they are and exactly who they're hanging out with. And I said, what? She said, well, I know there's two-year-olds who already know what sex is because they've seen it on TV. And I just don't want my daughter being with that family. And I said, so what do you do? She's like, yeah, there's not really family stuff to do on a Friday night. There used to be a go-kart place, but that shut down. And I just thought, wow, I didn't even realize my wife and I have the opposite problem. Or my kid is like, why can't I go to the semi-pro baseball game? I'm like, because we have this church event. It's like, what about the one next week? Well, we have a school event that night, and then grandma's having us over. We have the opposite problem. And it's always through these hubs, these institutions, that we get this connection. We get a sense of purpose. And that the civil society deserts, that's really... And men lacking sense of purpose is another big part of it. I try to say, like, idleness is an affliction, not just, you shouldn't think of it as a vice. It's an affliction. I'm not idle, not because I wake up every morning and say, God put me on this earth to work and I'm going to serve him and I'm going to, no, I'm busy because people are always asking me to do things. And you guys know the look, like you're at church or at the pool and you see the person walking in a beeline towards you. They're going to make me do something. I think I tell the story in the book of the basketball coaching. I was standing in the back of Mass and I was like, Katie, we got to go. Because I saw the athletic director beelining towards me and he caught me. Tim, hey, I see Meg is signed up for basketball. Yep. It's like, it's great. We've got enough girls to run a parish basketball team, but we need a coach. I was like, I think Austin used to coach. She's like, no, Tim, I'd like you to coach. And I said, okay. Meg was in kindergarten at this point. Kindergarten basketball should not exist, all right? And I just said, Mike, any other year I would do this. This year I'm extra busy. Oh, what are you doing? I'm writing a book. What's the book about? It's about the importance of community. And so you are looking at the kindergarten girls basketball coach for St. Andrew Apostle Parish. But that doesn't answer solutions, right? How do we reverse, how do we make these civil society deserts into richer ecosystems? There's no federal department of local community cohesion that could possibly be created. Even on the state level, there's limits to what can be done. In my solutions chapter, I sort of throw out a lot of things. One, walkability is really important. You guys might all have cars that you can drive around in, but for working class, middle class, having your downtown be walkable where you bump into neighbors, having, again, the church, the civic center, the library be walkable allows parents to set their kids running around without them getting run over crossing a 6-lane road. It really is key to build things on a local level in a walkable way. Other policies that sort of isolate families from one another. Our tax code encourages people to buy bigger, more expensive houses than they should. I would get rid of that. But really, the key is going to be, and especially talking to a crowd like this, giving your time to civic institutions that bring people together, specifically people who might not have those institutions in their daily life. Whenever I speak on a college campus, I usually point to the big gym that's named after a billionaire donor or the library. And I say, if you become a billionaire, do that. Build institutions. If you don't become a billionaire, which is far more likely, I then point to the sign at my T-ball field, the Dottoli's Diamond. Mike Dottoli did not bankroll our Little League field, our T-ball diamond. Mike Dottoli volunteered as a coach in our parish every year. He died young until his death. So not everybody can be, you know, the Van Andels or the Skinners or whatever, that their name is on everything because they're billionaires, but everybody can be Mike Dottoli. So there's great policy debates that have, but much more simple for everybody in this room. Like, you can be Mike Dottoli. Give your time to institutions that bring people together, particularly the working class, whether it's in downtown Jacksonville or out in Baker County.
So getting into moving from your book, maybe to more relevant kind of data that's going on. So in your book, you talk about the Trump voter, or at least the person that was interested in then candidate Trump, was disinterested in politics prior to 2015. They were apathetic to voting. I saw your recent article. You said that the preliminary data for 2020 is that those voters were still overwhelmingly supportive to President Trump. And so I'm wondering, because you write, you don't think that President Trump caused alienation in America, and that he really didn't fix it. So as we look forward the next 2-4 years, we know that demographics are shifting. More Hispanic voters and more African-American voters are trending towards the Republican Party. Give us your take on maybe what you see moving forward with political demographics changing, but also this question. If President Trump didn't fix alienation, who can fix alienation? Does it take a unified government instead of a very divided two-party government?
So the realignment is really interesting. Republicans are increasingly becoming the working class party, and not even just the working class white party. Obviously, Democrats are winning the vast majority of the black vote, a strong majority of the Hispanic vote. But if you look at it, if you break it down by income and education level, Republican gains among white, black, and Hispanic non-college voters is massive. And I would argue that it's the same phenomenon that I documented about the overwhelmingly white working class in alienated America, is that so there's the way to look at it is, you know, Prince George's County is the adjacent county to mine, and it's got a lot of middle class, upper middle class black neighborhoods. I got to crunch those numbers. I would bet you Trump did not make any gains in those neighborhoods where church attendance and marriage is high. He made his gains among voters, again, who are disenchanted and alienated and feel that the modern world isn't working for them. Their jobs are going to China, or lower wage immigrants are being hired over them. That's where, and you saw Trump just with these massive surges in these counties in the Rio Grande Valley, in these working class Hispanic towns in Massachusetts. With the, again, initial data, will have verified voter numbers down the line, but that the Republican Party is realigning to be a slightly more multi-ethnic working class party, and the Democratic Party is becoming the party of college educated, I use the word elites. I hope that's not derogatory. I went to a liberal arts college and I'm from Greenwich Village. I don't mean it as any sort of insult. But this is sort of Chuck Schumer's actual plan. He has long been trying to drag Democrats away from where they sort of were under Bill Clinton towards being the party that dominates the suburbs. He said, if I become majority leader, my number one priority is going to remove the cap on the state and local tax deduction. Like, that's not a party of the little guy to make sure that people in New York and New Jersey can deduct more than $10,000 of state and local income taxes, waive all college debt. That doesn't help 80% of the country. So there's a deliberate ploy among the Democrats to become that party, in part because suburban college educated voters are much higher propensity than working class black, white, or Hispanic voters. So could the way I'll answer your solutions question is this: could the unified Democratic Party materially improve life for the sort of alienated working class? See, I don't think a minimum wage hike does that, in part because Raj Chetty, an economist, he found that one of the best predictors of upward mobility for children was teenage labor force participation. So if you raise the wages for a 25-year-old in a low-skilled job and the trade-off is eliminating the job for the 18-year-old, that's precisely undermining some of this stuff. I'm not saying that that trade-off isn't worth it, but on the question of alienation and community cohesion, taking away the ability of, you know, of 18 year, because some places have exemptions on their minimum wage for high school age kids, but taking away the ability of younger people to hold down jobs is weakening communities. Mitt Romney's proposal, and I'll be talking about this on a AEI panel in a couple hours, Mitt Romney's proposal to provide a child allowance in replace of some other federal aid is something that a lot of Democrats have expressed an interest in. And so that could be the sort of thing, if you're taking away policies that disincentivize work and replace them with just a blanket allowance, that could be exactly the sort of thing. If it ends up promoting marriage, that could be good. Things that even make it easier for a working class family to decide that the mom or the dad is going to stay home, as long as they're married, then you're not, this is not the idle man dropping out of the workforce, but this is a stay-at-home parent who's going to be on the front porch. When I was in McClenny, they said, my kids hated growing up here because by the time they got to the front door, I already knew what they had done wrong. And so promoting stay-at-home parents, I think, would be a beneficial thing. Biden's economists don't want to do that. They want to promote more women in the workplace. But if they compromise with Mitt Romney and say, we just want to help families and they can make up their mind what to do with the money, that could end up being a sort of thing that could address alienation. Ultimately, what Democrats support, Biden supporting private sector labor unions, that could be a solution. And this is not a conservative thing to say. And I'm on the government labor unions, don't get me started on the teachers unions, but on the private sector labor unions, those were a very important hub of civil society for the working class. They have eroded immensely. If they can sort of be reborn, and there are tweaks I would make to labor law to make them act more as hubs of civil society, that could have some positive effects. None of these are things I think are likely to work out the way I want them to, but you asked me a question, so I'm trying to give you something to work with.
I appreciate that. I want to stick to, you'd mentioned with those that go to church regularly, and this is a theme in Alienated America. You've been continuing to write about it in the Washington Examiner. You wrote a piece called Believers But Not Belongers. And the quote that I wrote down was, increasingly, Americans see themselves as believers but not belongers. Religion in America is receding, but even among the religious faith is becoming deinstitutionalized. We hear a lot about religious liberty protections having kind of a second wind with the appointment of Justices Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett. But if the statistics are that individuals are not going to church as often as they used to, mm-hmm. We saw Senator Cruz did well with individuals that went to church every week, then candidate Trump did better with those that didn't. Should we continue to place an emphasis on protecting religious liberty and religious freedom, or should we maybe focus on something else? What's your thought there?
No, I think that religious institutions and that belonging to institutions is absolutely essential. I mean, you talk about solutions throughout American history. The central institution of civil society, the central little platoon for the working class and middle class in America, always has been the local religious congregation. And that a secularized America is sort of bearable in Chevy Chase, Maryland, or in, you know, a college-educated elite suburb, because they replace church with other institutions. Although if you go to Brett Kavanaugh's parish in Chevy Chase, the pews are a lot more packed there than they are in Southern Maryland, in rural Southern Maryland. But secularization has not proved survivable for the working class and middle class in America. And that what Neil Gorsuch is so important, because he's a trailblazer. I mean, I read his decisions that he made on the circuit court about religious, the RFRA and First Amendment cases. And he made it very clear that the government has a duty not to sort of tolerate religion, but to accommodate it. And that free exercise of religion is an explicitly protected right in the First Amendment. And that the right of institutions to be not just President Obama had a very grating term he sometimes used, freedom of worship, which those words are not in the First Amendment, as you know. It's a free exercise of religion. And so defending religious institutions' abilities to be in the public square is crucial, in part because by being in the public square, it's how you can't exercise your religion as a Christian if you don't love your neighbor. And you can't, and loving your neighbor is not just sitting in your quiet prayer room saying, God bless my neighbor, or as they say in the South, bless her heart. That loving your neighbor means serving your neighbor, and that churches need to be. I met with a pastor at Celebration Church, and he just said, we just realized that our focus has to be going out to the zip codes in Jacksonville that have the most single moms and the most kids at risk and serving them. And that's how we live our faith. That's how we exercise our religion. Florida is almost unique in the ability, the willingness of state and county governments to work with religious institutions without then saying, oh, by the way, Mary, Mother of Mercy, you have to ordain women. Or by the way, Celebration Church, you're not allowed to teach what you teach about gender. So if more states were like Florida, we'd be in a lot better case, because that allows the churches, the synagogues, the mosques to be what they need to be, institutions of civil society. And the more that they're out there, and Celebration Church isn't trying to get the Black single mothers in Jacksonville to come out to Celebration Church. They're actually working through the local Baptist church. And they're saying, we're not even trying to get them to show up at the local Baptist church, but you know that that's part of the goal to get to. They're saying, we're trying to build connections, get these, no program ever helped somebody, relationships did. That's what I hear again and again. And that churches as institutions that are allowed to work in the public, even with public funds, without being forced to violate their own conscience, is absolutely essential. If you care about the poor, you have to keep fighting for that aspect of religious liberty.
And I think that's a good transition to another topic. But so on the topic of religious liberty in schools, since you've been writing a lot about schools, in Alienated America, you talk about the importance of parochial schools to community, not just rural communities, mm-hmm. but urban communities. And I found this observation pretty astounding. You wrote, quote, disorder, distrust, and fear all rise up when a Catholic school leaves an urban neighborhood. And that was based on a study from the National Catholic Education Association. So tell us a little bit more. Obviously, the church brings great community because it's focusing on individuals and families. But how important to you is parochial schools playing in combating the alienation problem in America?
So what's true about parochial schools can be true about public schools or all sorts of other schools. But what's exceptional about a small local Catholic school, it's so clear during COVID, is a sense of solidarity that when we shut down our schools before the public schools in March, and then over the summer, we announced our reopening plan, and then the county government said, no, you're not allowed to reopen. And we fought back like crazy. We had lawsuits lined up. And then eventually our governor, Larry Hogan, saved us and voided the county's health office's bans on our reopening. But when I talked to some of the teachers about it, and they said, well, here's the thing. Every parent is on board with our universal mask mandate for every you're dropping your kids off, even though we're outdoors, and I think masks outdoors are unnecessary, but we don't want the county to bust us, and we just want to set the tone. We are not fooling around with this virus. Every parent said, I don't want to wear a mask outdoors, but if Father Dan says it, and if Principal Sheehan says it, I'm going to do it. Why? Because we love this institution. We respect that these are legitimate authorities. We are buying in, both literally and figuratively, into this institution. So we take it really seriously. The teachers feel a debt to their employer in a way that's very different from the way a unionized employee is going to say, I'm going to extract as much out of my employer as possible because I think they'll exploit me when they get the chance. in a public school in a place like Montgomery County, 160,000 students in the school district, you feel like you just sort of get assigned, like a bureaucrat assigns you to a school and you show up. And there's some great principals and some great teachers who really try to rope in the families and make them feel that way. But it's very easy to not have that sense of solidarity in sort of a massive public school district. And so the key to a parochial school, which is not unique to them, but is much more present in them, is again, that sense of we are all in the same thing together. So if somebody asks me to do something, I'm more likely to do it. Again, even if it's wearing a mask outside, which when the DC mayor tells me to wear a mask outside, I say, no, Ms. Bowser, I'm not doing that. When Father Mel tells me to wear a mask outside, I wear a mask outside. Maybe this is feeding into Catholic stereotypes that we just do what we're told, but it really is that I just know this is us. Like the parish isn't those other people, it's us. And that's just much more likely on a small local level and a small locally controlled public school. Even if you lose the debate, you say, okay, well, we decided this. A big, massive, nameless, faceless public school, like in a lot of suburban counties and a lot of cities, that's not us, that's them. And we just got assigned to that school. So that's, I think, the key thing there is that solidarity promotes community trust.
Now, we'll shift into the school reopening. I do have a question about some pretty mean tweets that you are getting from social media. But before that, you've been writing on school reopening since, or schools in general, from the start of COVID. You were initially supportive of closing schools, yep, primarily because of the uncertainty about the virus and what it would do. In Florida, we've been blessed. We're now at the year anniversary of when Governor DeSantis and our Surgeon General declared a public health emergency. We closed schools for the end of last year, but we've been open this entire school year. I'm wondering, because you've been writing about it, many states are still not offering in-person options like Florida is. What do you think are the short-term and long-term unintended impacts of these prolonged school closures, not having the in-person schooling?
I think there will be learning losses and mental health costs. I think we'll only learn in the long run what the mental health costs are. I think there was no COVID baby boom. People thought, oh, men and women, couples locked up together, they're going to have more babies. That didn't happen. I would not be surprised if there was a COVID divorce boom. I think that though there's going to be some positive and unexpected things. I mean, a minority, maybe about 10 to 15% of students, I hear from their parents are like, oh, they love it. They skip the Zoom class, they get their packet, they bang it out, and then they, you know, run around outside or play on video games or just go over to their friend's house. There's some kids whose school is just such a waste of time. And they're so self-motivated that they can do it. None of these are my kids. I said 15%. That should have been one of my kids, but it kind of was my first grader, I guess, but he's too young to notice. But I think there will be lots of interesting things that we learn about schooling and that there will be interesting uses of remote learning. I hope it doesn't lead to the permanent cancellation of snow days. Now, some of you guys went to law school in Indiana or are not from here, but snow days really are the greatest thing. They might be gone forever. That would be a horrible negative unintended consequence. But you know, I work at AI with a lot of economists and they always look for sort of sudden shocks that provide interesting data. I think we're going to learn a million new things out of this. And some of it's going to be good. There's going to be things that are better in the future because of what we learned during this horrible episode.
So yeah, in your December piece talking about the schools reopening, you mentioned the mental health, but also some of the learning curves. For example, a McKinsey study said students on average were about 3 months behind where they should have been in mathematics, and that students of color were 3 to 5 months behind in learning. So what do you think? I mean, what are some of the solutions? We can't go back. Schools have been mm-hmm. closed. We don't have in-person unless you're in Florida. So what do school districts do now where we're still trying to figure out the next steps in a school reopening plan?
First thing I would do is not try to catch up. Some schools said, oh, we lost so much learning last spring, we're going to make up for it. I think that we need to that schools providing the material that we learn is very important, but the main thing schools do, and so when I write about how the college educated are doing so much better in America, it's not because college taught you how to like get married or how to stay married in some class. It's because the socialization and the skills are the key part of school. So just getting them back in person, finding out where they are and learning. The book idea I'm working on next, one of the chapters is have lower ambitions for your kids. And so that's what I would say. It's like, all right, if we can graduate everybody in a few years and they're at the 11th grade level of Latin and math or whatever, I'm fine with that. Get them back in person. They don't need to catch up. But again, also then remember, why are we getting together in person? If it's for that socialization, that community building, orient the time that we're together more towards that and less towards meeting these educational attainment goals. This is what I think about workplaces too. If it's easier to work remotely on the days that everybody's in the office, focus on connecting and building those connections and that trust rather than banging out the briefs that you can do from home.
So before I go into the last topic of questions that I have, I just want to remind the folks in person, if you have a question, please write it down. Adam will come and get it from you. And if you're watching in Zoom, please use the Q&A or chat function to submit your questions. So I referenced the keyboard warriors. So we'll go into kind of, first we'll continue on the school reopening, then I want to go into cancel culture. This is a tweet that I just have to read for everybody that you received in regards to a New York Times op-ed that you wrote criticizing the Biden administration for their claim to be science first, mm-hmm. but then there ended up just really conflicting with the CDC and going with the union. So the tweet at you was, Timothy P. Carney needs to keep it in his pants. A father of six insisting that Biden's reopening plan is based on fear is disingenuous at best and ignorant at its worst. So first I've got to know, is that the overwhelming response to that New York Times op-ed?
That was a particularly sort of well or poorly phrased version of the common response. But yes, I also note that guy says that being ignorant is worse than being disingenuous. And I would disagree with that, but...
So I'm wondering, because, you know, you've wrote about this from the beginning. And like I said, at the start of this topic area, you were supportive of school closures at the beginning until we learned the science. So I'm wondering, do we have is alienated America causing people to attack a father of six,
yeah,
when they have a criticism of government or what they believe is going to be best for their family? And why should it be seen with skepticism that parents are speaking out saying, this is what I want to do for my kids?
Yeah, I think this definitely relates to alienation in that a lot of people think, well, the experts are the only ones who are allowed to have opinions. And so that's a very undemocratic, disenfranchising idea that parents aren't supposed to have opinions on schooling. I mean, multiple people said, oh, another dad is piping in. And I don't know whether that was a gendered criticism that dads either should keep their mouth shut, or whether that was mostly saying you parents need to shut your mouth about school and listen to the education experts. A technocracy where we say experts should handle everything is one where average people have less say. And when average people have less say, that is a breeding ground of alienation. And that the more that people's attention is centralized to the federal government, where most of us don't have any real say, the more people feel helpless. Well, I changed the world mostly through my parish and my local government. And I got them to turn the baseball field back into a baseball field by leveraging the pastor and getting somebody to work at a discount and getting a little money. I lobbied my local government to change the lines and make a right turn only lane near my intersection. So like, if you look at my neighborhood from Google satellites, it looks a little different because I was able to work with local institutions. I was able to change the world through that regard. If you say, regular people shouldn't have any say on traffic intersections, and well, we're gonna, you know, just run all sports through a county board of rec where there's going to be experts, then people stop caring. They stop knowing their neighbors. They lose trust. So that attitude that parents need to shut up about schools is part of this technocratic mindset that leads to alienation, because people are not supposed to just mind their own business. Human beings are a political animal, and we're supposed to shape the world around us. And that includes lobbying my public schools, even when I send my kids to the Catholic schools.
So, and kind of switch then to the cancel culture. So you're not allowed to give an opinion because you disagree with the government, and maybe because of your libertarian and conservative tendencies. So you wrote maybe it was last month or just a couple of weeks ago, on cancel culture, and you talked about these speech police. You mentioned that employees are getting fired due to ill-advised tweets. We know that there are college students who are having their scholarships taken away for things that they said when they were 14 or 13 years old. In Florida, we're blessed. The Governor DeSantis, along with the House Speaker, are proposing legislation to kind of go after, you know, these social media giants and the democratizing of speech, the creepy, I think, let me see, I'm gonna get this right. You called them the creepy speech police. So just give us your quick take on what social media, big tech is doing to what should be a free exercise, a marketplace of ideas, and you being able to criticize school reopening plans.
Well, the tricky thing is, right, we were talking about religious liberty. I don't want to force a baker to bake a cake he doesn't want to bake. So should I force Twitter to carry opinions that Twitter finds offensive? So the sort of legislative legal solutions are complicated, but it's at least worth noting that Twitter pretends to have these neutral rules. And I call them dirty cops, who, like, they have a vagrancy law that is there mostly to enforce against the bad guys. You see a black guy show up in your white town, you say, well, we've got these laws about how you need to have two forms of ID, and so we're going to kick you out. That's what the sort of the rules at Twitter or Facebook are about. They make rules that they have no intention of applying equally. When they censored the Joe Biden, the Hunter Biden article right before the election, Twitter's first explanation was, well, this is using content that was not authorized to be taken. And everybody laughed. Yes, because when Donald Trump's taxes get published, you're really going to not let people read those? The Pentagon Papers? Come on. And then they said, well, we didn't think the New York Post piece was properly reported out. On Twitter? Really? 99% of the crap on Twitter is not properly reported out, and none of those get flagged. And so they have these rules. And then Merriam-Webster decided that sexual preference was a slur because Amy Coney Barrett said it, while the same reporters who were saying, I can't believe she used that slur, they used the term the week before. Because these aren't rules. They're pretend rules. And they use it to go after the bad guys because they want to, I don't know that Twitter wants to silence the opinions, but they don't want backlash from their, either A, their woke millennial staff, or B, the Democratic lawmakers who happen to hold their future in their hands. Notably, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, who's on the Commerce Committee, Nancy Pelosi, around January 6th, called on Amazon and others to sort of deplatform Trump and Parler and that sort of thing. And they did it. Why? Well, when the speaker holds subsidies and regulations of you or can regulate your competitors out of business, you're going to go along with them. So I really think that the sort of the problem is not the power that the platforms have so much. Maybe it is. But I think that when the platforms and the people who are in charge of government are on the same page, then the rest of us need to worry that the concentration of economic power can be scary. The concentration of government power is scary. The two of them getting together is very scary.
So just as a final follow-up to that question, with social media, big tech's kind of stranglehold, like you said, their willingness to just go at the whim of the Democratic Party or whoever's in power, what can we as Americans do to kind of push back? Do we have any influence on pushing back on social media and big tech?
I don't know. I mean, I think that I talked about mental health earlier. We'd all be healthier if we spent less time on Twitter and Facebook, and maybe that's the answer. I think people with a voice like me, like some of you, sometimes have an obligation to stand up and articulate unpopular positions, particularly if you're in a position to do it well. I mean, I'm not a Republican or a Democrat, but I got to admit, I know I'm closer to the Republican Party because when Democrats say something awful, I feel vindicated, and Republicans say something awful, I feel embarrassed. And every time Republicans try to speak up either on gender ideology or even still on like gay marriage or any of these other things, it's a comment that causes me to wince. So what I would say is, if you have the ability to speak with knowledge and love on a topic that's increasingly becoming verboten, you have a responsibility to articulate that opinion if you can do it again with love and knowledge. So whether you're talking climate, whether you're talking about the social war stuff or immigration policy or whatever, if you have an opinion that's gonna be deemed hate speech soon, study up on it so you can say it well and plant a flag and say, this is an acceptable opinion.
Right, great. So we'll move into the audience question. So we did have one in person. And the question was, how has the opioid crisis, which clearly hasn't gone away, affected the trends or conclusions from Alienated America?
So that's a great question, because it really was one of the things that I'm a free market guy, but it makes me question like sort of the effects of free trade when you go to a place like Uniontown, Pennsylvania, or a lot of these former factory towns, because the economic account is, well, the stuff gets made in China instead of Pittsburgh. It then is lower price. So then the consumers have more of a surplus. And with that surplus, the people who used to work in manufacturing sort of slide into a slightly lower paid service job. That didn't happen. Those places are not just populated with service jobs now. They died. People, there's divorces, there's lack of marriage, there's drug addiction, there's suicide, and there's death. David Autor is an economist from MIT, and he wrote about how deaths of despair can be predicted by looking at places whose economies were competing with China at the time that China entered into the WTO. Your exposure to China competition predicts deaths of despair. So that's a way in which us not being sort of homo economicus has shown that people don't just quickly adapt. All right, I guess I can't be a steel worker anymore. I'll just do what's next. That's just not the way people work. So the opioid deaths and other deaths of despair are really what drove home to me. And the way I sort of build up the book is by saying a lot of this is progress at a price. We lose a steel mill, but we gain international trade. And then I said, some of this price is not something that we can easily write off on one side of the ledger or the other. It's real and it's deep.
And then I've got a Zoom question, and I'm not sure exactly where this was coming, but the question is there any hope for the kind of sensible things you've suggested if the overwhelming predominant media virtually never hire a person with your perspective?
If you asked me this 3 years ago, I would have said, no, the media hires conservatives all the time. But now, imagine if the New York Times tried to hire Ross Douthat today, or the Washington Post tried to hire Megan McArdle today. I mean, there would be a revolution. I don't know. The thing that has mattered to me most over the last year was getting and keeping schools open. And here you do see a lot of the mainstream media, about 50% of them say, well, you know, I think the teachers unions are being a little bit excessive here. So maybe some excesses can cause a pendulum to swing back. But right now, I think, the media doesn't know how to handle. Do you remember, like 10 years ago, there'd be these journalism students at University of Missouri who were like protesting somebody having a bad opinion. And among conservatives, there'd be a sort of hearty chuckle. Oh, those guys are going to be in for a rude awakening when they enter into the workforce. And now we wake up 10 years later to a rude awakening that they're now in charge. So the answer is no. I think what matters is that conservatives continue to try to find ways not just to own the libs, but to express their dissenting opinions in ways that are done with both knowledge and love, and also to build up our own institutions. The Washington Examiner news page tries not to be slanted. We hire lots of people who are definitely left of center on the news page, but the opinion page is there partly to allow people like me and Byron York to write our opinions without fear.
And then I've just got one kind of final softball question. So to kind of bring it all together, at the end of Alienated America, you talk about some of the solutions that we've gone through today, but you say you want to talk about St. Andrews, which mm-hmm. is your home parish. And you write, quote, "If you're serious about addressing America's social problems, you have to begin where you are." And I know you've talked about that with us today. I'm wondering if St. Andrews you said it wasn't a model nationwide, but rather a foundation stone. So as we're all here, lawyers, members of the community, those watching are hopefully influential members of the community. If you had to give us the first two or three steps mm-hmm. of beginning where we are to solve this problem, what would you tell all of us?
A line I said earlier that's not in the book, because I learned it on the book tour from social workers. No program ever helped anybody. Relationships help people. This was somebody who worked with single moms, drug addicts, high school dropouts, that sort of thing. Realize that you are privileged and that your privilege is the connections that you have. Think about what you would, you know, you could almost put a price tag. You can't, but you could almost put a price tag on the ability to call somebody and say, "Hey, I won't be home in time. Can you pick up my kid from school?" Or the ability just to leave your kids' bikes on the front lawn and not worry about them getting carted off, and that the social trust that's built into that. So realize that your privilege is your connection, and realize that you do have a duty. And you know, I say this as a Christian, but I think it's widely held. You do have a duty to help the people who are worse off than you, and that the best way you can help them is welcoming them into building institutions for them to get connections, not connections to power necessarily, but connections to neighbors and other people. And again, I would go back to Mike Dottoli. Like, think about that. If your legacy ends up being, you know, one conference room in a local library is named after you because you led a mentoring group, or one baseball field in your town is named after you and a sign that's going to get overgrown, that's one heck of a legacy. That is the way. I've got no one big solution in the book, but I hope that, you know, if we have 40 people between this room and watching on TV, there's 40 little solutions here of people who are going to give to their community in a way that gives people connection and belonging.
Well, that's all the time that we have, Tim. I really appreciate you coming down to Florida and speaking with us here in person and in everybody virtually. If I can give a plug to Alienated America, it's 2 years old at this point, but it's still very relevant. And then also, if you follow Tim on Twitter or his Washington Examiner pieces, they're phenomenal. They're great reads. So again, thank you for coming down and being with us today. Everybody online, thank you for watching, and kind of be on the lookout for more information from the Jacksonville Federalist Society and all the other Florida chapters. So we appreciate it, and have a great day.